In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
We're going to go around during the break and introduce ourselves, but I'll just say I'm John Marciano. This is the third year of the People's History Group. The usual format is that I try to bring together some reflections on the readings and the issues for the evening based on a great deal of scholarship, present a lecture, and then we open it up for discussion. And if anyone wants those comments, which I have written out as a formal delivered paper, because it may be that I will turn these 10 months of comments into a book on imperialism, empire. So I will be happy to email you or send you month by month these written comments that you can then read at your leisure and get back to me. Our discussion will address my comments when we open it for discussion, but especially the articles and books. So I would ask that you bring that material each month so that we can actually address a particular paragraph or argument. And I would also ask that we try to address the substance of the readings in the comments and to avoid unrelated current issues, which are certainly pressing, but that's not our purpose here. I would ask that you try to approach the readings in what I would call a critical spirit. That means look for the basic arguments and assumptions, the reasoning in the articles and books, the evidence for the claims that are made, the contradictions or weaknesses in the arguments. Concentrate on the major assertions and don't worry about minor details. This is a foundations course on the U.S. empire, its root causes, its nature, and its history. It's not a methods course on how we deal with or end imperialism tomorrow, though we certainly will discuss current and future strategies, especially when we discuss the last group of readings in June. So we want to get a sense of the foundational premises of these issues. Okay, empire as a way of life. What I'd like to do is to begin our discussions with some comments on the dominant view of empire or imperialism that all of us have been brought up with, especially in this society, drawing upon the words of leading political and intellectual advocates. I'll then follow this with a brief critique of the dominant view and a look also at William Appleman Williams' article, Empire as a Way of Life. The British historian Eric Cobsbawm writes that there are few things more dangerous than empires pursuing their own interests in the belief that they are doing humanity a favor. In order to understand these gifts that U.S. empire builders and propagandists believe they've given to the world, we need to get some appreciation of the dominant view that we learned as we were going through our educational years, that we've learned from the mass media, and that we also picked up in religious institutions. One of the leading godfathers of the American empire was our 28th president, Woodrow Wilson, 1913-1921. "Sometimes people call me an idealist," Wilson once said. "Well, that's the way I know I am an American. America is the only idealistic nation in the world. Political theorist Ronald Steele, who is no neoconservative apologist for the U.S. empire, concurs. And I quote, America is an idealistic nation based on the belief that the self-evident truths of the Declaration of Independence should be extended to unfortunate peoples wherever they may be. This view of America, however, began long before Wilson. The myth of America as God's chosen people, the New Israel, began with the invasion of the Americas by English colonists in the 17th century. John Winthrop, one of the first leaders of the Massachusetts Puritans, stated, "We shall find that the God of Israel is among us, that men shall say of succeeding settlements, the Lord make it like that of New England. For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon the hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." Historian Lauren Barrett points out that the myth of America as a city on the hill implies that it is a moral example for the rest of the world. It means that we are a chosen people. This dogmatic and often self-righteous nationalism resembles that of other countries. He states that between God's country and holy Russia, there is not much of a choice. Between ideas of moral superiority and racial superiority, there is even less of a choice, since one invariably leads to the other. The glory of France, the dominion of Britain, the power and racial purity of the Third Reich, the satisfaction of thinking of oneself as the cradle of civilization, the willingness to die for one's uniquely favored country has no national boundary. Writing in 1967, Ronald Steele viewed the moral inspiration of America's involvement in foreign wars as undeniable. This was surely found during the Cold War, when the rhetoric of our diplomacy rested upon the indivisibility of freedom, the belief in self-determination, the necessity for collective security, and the sanctity of peaceful as opposed to violent change. These values were particularly evident after World War II, during the decision to rebuild and defend Western Europe. When the United States acted with wisdom, humanity, and an enlightened conception of her own institutions. Steele claims that we see ourselves as the defenders of freedom and democracy in the contest against tyranny because we are, in President John Kennedy's words, by destiny rather than choice, the watchmen on the walls of freedom. Our empire building has appealed to a deep-rooted instinct in our national character, an instinct to help those less fortunate and permit them to emulate and perhaps one day achieve the virtues of our own society. It rested on the belief that it was America's role to make the world a happier, more orderly place, one more nearly reflecting our own image. For example, Steele asserts that in opposition to the efforts of France, Britain, and Holland to regain control of their Asian colonies after World War II, the United States encouraged the efforts of such nationalists as Nehru in India, Sukarno in Indonesia, and Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam to win the independence of their countries. The U.S. took over from the departed European colonial powers. We did this with good intentions, because we believed in self-determination for everybody as a guiding moral principle. This effort found its roots in our most basic and generous national instincts. The post-World War II view of the U.S. as the chosen nation was also articulated by the influential diplomat George Kennan, whose important article on the Cold War in 1947 advanced the belief that the leadership of the free world was thrust upon American people by divine providence and the laws of both history and nature. Kennan told his readers that providence had made their entire security as a nation dependent on their pulling themselves together and accepting the responsibilities of moral and policy leadership that history plainly intended them to bear. Now, this enthusiasm over generations for American principles has also shaped the rhetoric of U.S. presidents, including recent U.S. presidents. Accepting the Republican nomination in 1988, for example, George Bush I lauded America as the leader, a unique nation with a special role in the world. This has been called the American century because in it we were the dominant force for good in the world. Now we are on the verge of a new century, and what country's name will it bear? I say it will be another American century. George Bush II has followed in his father's rhetorical footsteps, and I quote, "Our nation is the greatest force for good in history." He has praised the glories of the U.S. and the need to share these with the world. As he states it, the U.S. will promote moderation, tolerance, and the non-negotiable demands of human dignity, the rule of law, limits on the power of the state, and respect for women, private property, free speech, and equal justice. Humanity holds in its hands the opportunity to offer freedom's triumph over its age-old foes. The U.S. welcomes its responsibility to lead in this great mission. Despite its flaws, our nation is chosen by God and commissioned by history to be the model to the world of justice and inclusion and diversity without division. I just get heart palpitations when I read that. And we're chosen by God, so there's not much we can do. Such sentiments are bipartisan, of course, in nature, and, for example, were articulated by Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. If we have to use force, it is because we are America. We are the indispensable nation. Right after the 9/11 attacks, military historian Victor Davis Hanson argued that our war against terrorism preserves Western civilization with its uniquely tolerant and human traditions of freedom, consensual government, disinterested inquiry, and religious and political tolerance. When Hanson was growing up in California in the 1940s and 50s, he said Americans knew their country was not merely different from others, but that it was clearly superior in its rare democratic government, tolerance for religious differences, spirit of liberty, and allowance for dissent. The scholars Ziadun Zadar and Merrill Wynne Davies assert that there is a feel-good factor in such a reading of history. The American people are reassured that their nation is good, acting disinterestedly and nobly according to its enduring values. Therefore, most Americans believe that America has the right to be imperialist. There is an inner fitness in America, they really mean the United States of America, forged by its founding principles that makes it the right nation to be preeminent. If America is the very idea of an ideal nation, then it follows that American democracy has the right to be imperialist and express itself through empire. Now, affirmations of U.S. goodness, especially from the late 19th and early 20th century, are being trotted out again, articulated by imperialist supporters such as Max Boot, a former editor with the Wall Street Journal who writes a syndicated column in the Los Angeles Times, and historians Niall Ferguson of New York University and Michael Ignatieff, former director of the Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard and now a member of the Canadian Parliament. John Bellamy Foster, you'll read one of Foster's articles in a couple of months, points out that with these representatives of the establishment openly espousing imperialist ambitions, we shouldn't be surprised at the repeated attempts to bring back Rudyard Kipling's white man's burdens argument in one form or another. In his book, The Savage Wars of Peace, Boot lauds the war against the Filipino people in the early 20th century and draws parallels with the current war in Iraq. He asserts that we should be encouraged that the bulk of the Filipino people did not resist American occupation, as they surely would have done if it had been nasty and brutal. He calls the Philippines War one of the most successful counterinsurgencies waged by a Western army in modern times. He claims that by the standards of the day, the conduct of U.S. soldiers was better than average for colonial wars. According to Boot, empire has been given a bad rap. The world today, he says, needs the U.S. to provide the sort of enlightened administration once provided by self-confident Englishmen. Niall Ferguson, who describes himself as a fully paid-up member of the neo-imperialist gang, argues that the U.S. has, whether it admits it or not, taken up some kind of global burden, just as Rudyard Kipling urged a century ago. It considers itself responsible for spreading the benefits of capitalism and democracy overseas. And just like the British Empire before it, the American Empire unfailingly acts in the name of liberty, even when its own self-interest is manifestly uppermost. Anti-war activist and scholar Anthony Arnov, who's written a fine book, by the way, that's on our bibliography, Iraq, The Logic of Withdrawal, he also highlights the views of some writers and theorists who have argued that imperialism, even colonialism, must be interpreted in a more positive light in the aftermath of 9/11. He cites Edward Rothstein of the New York Times, who admits that the word imperialism still jangles with jingoistic echoes, yet this idea is bound to change character. After all, instead of exploitation, imperialism is now being associated with democratic reform, sometimes to the great satisfaction of its subject. Maybe even 19th century imperialism will be reinterpreted and invoked by example, since many non-Western nations developed democratic institutions solely because of imperialist influence. Imperialism's exploitation often had a virtuous flip side. You just had to turn it over. Arnov reviews some of the affirmations of empire put forth by Michael Ignatieff, who he calls one of the most influential exponents of the imperialist school of thought, who gives a liberal veneer to the rather crude arguments of Boot and Ferguson. Ignatieff also argues that imperialism used to be the white man's burden. This gave it a bad reputation. But imperialism doesn't stop being necessary just because it becomes politically incorrect. There's that term. Nations sometimes fall, and when they do, only outside help, imperialist power, can get them back on their feet. He says, Ignatieff, that the burden of being an imperial power, however, is more than just being the most powerful nation or the most hated one. It means enforcing such order as there is in the world and doing so in the American interest. It means laying down the rules America wants while exempting itself from other rules that go against its interest. It also means carrying out important functions in places America has inherited from the failed empires of the 20th century. Ignatieff claims that 21st century imperialism is something new, an empire light, a global hegemon whose grace notes are free markets, human rights, and democracy, enforced by the most awesome military power the world has ever known. As writer and activist Sidney Lenz points out, the claims just have come generation after generation, the claims of U.S. benevolence are not new. The U.S., like other nations, has formulated a myth of morality to assuage its conscience and sustain its image. The U.S., we are told, has always tried to avoid war. When it has been forced to take the military road, it has seldom done so for motives of gain or glory. On the contrary, the wars are fought only for such high principles as freedom of the seas, the right of self-determination, and to halt aggression. In thought, as in deed, the United States has been anti-war and anti-imperialist. According to this myth, Lenz goes on, the U.S. has religiously respected the rights of other peoples to determine their own destiny. It has always been sympathetic to revolutions fighting for genuine independence. It has always refrained from interfering in the internal affairs of other nations. More than any other great nation, it has been guided by selfless concern for the less fortunate. So in a sense, this is the sort of laying out a picture of the dominant benevolent view. And we're going to shift gears a bit. Historian Howard Zinn's comment on influential imperialist apologists such as Michael Ignatieff will commence our critique of the dominant view that will essentially be the focus of our discussions for the next 9 months. We've all grown up with the dominant view. Now we're going to get the other side. As I used to indicate to my students when I taught college, they had the dominant view for 15 and a half years. I got them for 15 weeks. So we're going to balance it. Referring specifically to Ignatieff, Zinn writes, "Only someone blind to the history of the United States, its obsessive drive for control of oil, its endless expansion of military bases around the world, its domination of other countries through its enormous economic power, its violations of human rights of millions of people, whether directly or by proxy governments, could make such a statement." Now let's return to this dominant view for a bit and raise some questions and assertions that are essentially going to be examined as we meet over the coming months. For example, Ronald Steele's assertion about self-evident truths, the great statement in our Declaration of Independence, seems to me that even a cursory investigation, a high school knowledge of U.S. history, would show that when this statement was written, these truths did not extend to slaves or free blacks or the first Americans or women or the poor, nor have they been extended to the countless nations and people throughout the world who have been invaded by the United States over the centuries. When Steele asserts that during the Cold War, the thrust of U.S. policies was aimed at peaceful rather than violent change, he left out some glaring exception. For example, U.S. initiated and supported violence against Iran in 1953, Guatemala in 1954, Brazil in 1964, the Dominican Republic in 1965, Indonesia in 1965, and Vietnam, which was ongoing when Steele published his book in 1967. He has a slightly different edition that came out in 1970, which he takes a bit more critical look, especially at Vietnam. The idea that the United States was committed to peaceful change during the Cold War, or I might add, before or after, is historically, profoundly untrue. Steele also lauds the deep-rooted instinct in our national character to help others. A modest question. When did this instinct arise in U.S. history? During the genocidal wars against the first Americans? While we enslaved Africans and African Americans? When we invaded Florida, Mexico, Cuba, the Philippines? When did this instinct arise? Steele's assertion that the United States aided the struggle of Ho Chi Minh and the Vietnamese for national independence is simply mind-boggling. Absolutely mind-boggling. It is totally contradicted by the public record, a mountainous public record that reveals how, especially beginning with the Truman administration, the United States supported French efforts to reclaim Vietnam after World War II. The truth is that after World War II, the United States opposed Vietnamese independence at every step of the way, and all of us in this room know the tragic consequences of that policy in terms of millions of lives that were lost. Victor Davis Hanson's uncritical praise for Western civilization's unique and wonderful virtues omits a few things: the Inquisition, centuries of anti-Semitism in the European Holocaust of the 1930s and 40s, Western conquest and genocide in the Americas, slavery and imperialism. Just a few afterthoughts to this beneficent Western enlightenment. Hanson remembers the 1940s and 50s in California with triple rose-colored glasses. Nationally, of course, it was a time of apartheid terror in the South against blacks, in California. It was a time of forced removal of Japanese and Japanese Americans to concentration camps and a white supremacy directed at Latinos and others of color in California, and especially Los Angeles, which essentially was a southern racist city when it came to oppressed minorities. As for the assertions by the Bushes and others, Woodrow Wilson, you can find a lot of these assertions across time, of our God-given and honorable presence in the world, the scholar Robert Jensen argues that the present Bush's frequent invocation of a direct connection to God and truth, what we might call the pathology of the anointed, is a peculiar and particularly dangerous feature of American history and the greatest nation claims. The story that we have learned, again, in schools and from the mass media, and what we now tell ourselves, he says, goes something like this. Other nations through history have acted out of greed and self-interest, seeking territory, wealth, and power. Then came the U.S., touched by God, a shining city on the hill, whose leaders created the first real democracy and went on to be the beacon of freedom for people around the world. Unlike the rest of the world, we act out of a cause nobler than greed. We are the model of and the vehicle for peace, freedom, and democracy in the world. Jensen asserts that this is a story that can only be believed by people sufficiently insulated from the reality of U.S. actions abroad to maintain such illusions. It is tempting to laugh at and dismiss this rhetoric, he says, but the commonness of the chosen by God assertions and the lack of outrage or amusement at them suggest that these claims are taken seriously both by significant segments of the public and politicians. Max Boot's claim about the conduct of U.S. troops during our invasion of the Philippines in the early 20th century is profoundly wrong, given the documented evidence of the barbaric and racist actions of U.S. troops in that war. The U.S. invasion of the Philippines was a chilling precursor to the genocidal assault of the United States in Vietnam some 60 years later. The parallels between the two wars, the tactics, strategies, are quite striking, especially the level of racist violence against dehumanized enemies. Sidney Lenz reminds us that all of these imperial acts have been valiantly camouflaged in the rhetoric of defense. The wars against Indians were a defense against their rampages and violations of treaties. The war against Mexico was a defense of Texas. In Korea and Vietnam, the United States was defending helpless small powers against communist aggression. According to Lenz, the myth of morality wears thin against the record of history. Even a cursory look suggests that American politics have been motivated not by lofty concern for the needs of other people, but by America's own desire for land, commerce, markets, spheres of influence, investments. The primary focus has not been moral, but imperial. And this imperialism, the writer Stephen Lendman asserts, has been in our DNA since the early settlers confronted the first Americans and slaughtered millions of them to seize their land and resources. We even put language in our sacred Declaration of Independence to give us a birthright to do it, calling our native people merciless Indian savages. Anthony Arnold's criticism of Richard Rothstein's support for imperialism goes to the heart of the issue. As Arnold states, Rothstein distills perfectly the logic of the white man's burden in its historical and contemporary form. Never mind the millions subjugated, killed, starved, driven into forced labor, exposed to disease, abused, denied their cultural heritage, exploited, robbed. Forget about that. Imperialism was a force for democracy and civilization. It brought backward people into the light of civilization. Arnold dissents from the common refrain we now hear from the defenders of the U.S. empire, that is, the U.S. has had no territorial ambitions. He says the claim is demonstrably false. The U.S. conquered not only the lands of the Native Americans, who were ethnically cleansed as the colonies expanded westward, but also land from Mexico and Cuba, and of course the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Guam, etc. We will leave the final word in this critical review section to Sidney Lenz. I would suggest that with mountains of evidence and impeccable reasoning, Lenz correctly points out that America the benevolent does not exist and has never existed. The U.S. has pilfered large territories from helpless or near helpless peoples. It has violated hundreds of treaties and understandings. It has committed war crimes. It has wielded a military stick and a dollar carrot to forge an imperial empire such as humans have never known before. It has intervened ruthlessly in the life of dozens of nations. Now, with this dominant view and brief critique as background and context, let's just look briefly at some of the major assertions in William's short article. Now, we're going to return to this in December and January when we actually read the book. Williams was writing, the book originally came out in 1980. He states, "We have only just begun our confrontation with our imperial history, ethic, and psychology." He says, and unlike what Karl Marx said about religion, Williams' view is that imperialism has been the opiate of the American people. And when one looks objectively at U.S. history and the myths of God and patriotism, it may be hard to dispute that claim. He wishes to enlighten us about our actual history as an imperial people who must now order ourselves rather than policing and saving the world. Essentially, we must end the massive denial in our real history. And speaking for myself and others, a massive denial of our real history that has been hidden and or ignored in our schools, mass media, and religious institutions. It is a denial that is social and historical in origin, but has penetrated deeply into the psyches of all citizens in this country. So it's social and historical in context, but it's psychic in terms of the depth that it has moved to in our own lives. Williams wants us to think about empire as a way of life. It's a pattern of thought and action. It's developed over time, but he argues it was there at the founding. And he's got some marvelous quotes in the book from Madison and Jefferson and others. This is not some recent phenomenon associated with those neocon cabalists in Washington. It's been around. It keeps coming around. The pattern is habitual. It's institutionalized. It defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. It's a conception of the world and how it works. So our view rests on certain fundamental patterns of thought. He reminds us that our views about empire are based on certain foundational assumptions that all of us have. What we think about human nature, what we think about people, what we think about nations, what we think about morality, what we think about economics, what we think about politics, what we think about race. These assumptions shape the parameters in which we define issues and address problems. They influence our understanding of causes and consequences, options and range of action. For example, most of us have grown up with and used the language of the nation state, or national interest, or the national security, rather than that of social class when it comes to empire. We think of the U.S. doing this or that, and of course it does. We don't think of ruling elites within the U.S. shaping what the U.S. does and defining for us what national security is. We rarely assert that it is not simply the United States invading another nation, though it is that as well, but a particular and powerful class of men who make these decisions and claim to speak for the national interests and national security. And I do mean men, by the way, despite an occasional female apologist for U.S. violence abroad, such as Jean Kirkpatrick under Reagan, Madeleine Albright under Clinton, and Condoleezza Rice under Bush, too. Imperialism is hard and dirty man's work. But killing poor people in the third world has increasingly become an equal opportunity and multi-ethnic endeavor, as those such as Rice and Colin Powell show us as they now cast their violent shadow across the globe. When we talk about empire, we must confront the issue of power, according to Williams, the superior power of one group to exploit and violate another. He says that there are two associated but nevertheless different relationships involved here. One is the union of initially separate but related units of population that then comes under one central authority. That is, an empire governed as an imperial system in which one element asserts its superiority. He uses the example of the creation of the United States from the combination of the original 13 colonies. The other example cited by Williams is the forcible subjugation of formerly independent peoples by a wholly external power and their subsequent rule by the imperial metropolis. He uses the examples here of the U.S. attacks on first American nations and the U.S. seizure of part of Mexico in the 1840s, both of which were integrated into its imperial system. And there are other examples. Williams tells us that imperialism is essentially a fundamental loss of sovereignty or control. The superior power subjects an inferior one to its own preferences. The basic purpose of imperialism is for the dominant power, and I would argue more than that, the ruling class within the dominant power, to extract resources and economic surplus from the weaker power. The central goal is material exploitation and cultural hegemony or domination, as it has been for centuries with other empires. U.S. empire is no exception. Given the benefits, however, that accrue to the dominant power, because we're in a hierarchical exploitive relationship, it's no surprise, as Williams reminds us, that 20th century Americans have liked empire for the same reason their ancestors favored it in the 18th and 19th. It provided them with renewable opportunities, wealth, and satisfactions and benefits, including a psychic sense of well-being and power. This ideological or psychic benefit is linked to the patriotic appeals that influence so many of us in this society. Williams cites the English philosopher John Locke on the true nature of empire. Very simple statement by Locke. It involves taking wealth and freedom away from others to provide for your own welfare, pleasure, and power. Hey, I wish when we studied Locke in philosophy classes we would have seen this. That's what it's always been about. All the assertions about freedom and democracy and concern for the unfortunate are ideological rationalizations. And the earliest rationalizations, Williams tells us, in the West, centered on race and Christianity. Essentially a process in which good Christian gentlemen engaged in racist plunder against communities of color throughout the world. The manifestation of this Christian racism received a big blessing in the United States in the mid-19th century under the term manifest destiny. God, who of course was a white Anglo-Saxon male, gave U.S. citizens of especially English descent his blessings as they went about pillaging and destroying the land, culture, and people of the Americas, and also engaged in attacks upon the Irish, the Chinese, blacks, and others. Williams distinguishes, and you'll see this in his book, between what he calls soft and hard imperialism or soft and hard imperialists. However, I would suggest that it's a distinction that should not divert us from seeing these as simply different strategies toward the same end. Two wings of a single predator aimed at the same end, the racist exploitation of those whom Algerian author Frantz Fanon called the wretched of the earth. The writer Joseph Conrad discussed this process with regard to the genocidal terror committed by King Leopold and the Belgians in the Congo. In the Heart of Darkness in 1902, Conrad wrote, "They were conquerors, and for that you only want brute force. They grabbed what they could get for the sake of what was to be got. It was robbery with violence, murder on a great scale, and men going at it blind. The conquest of the earth, which mostly means taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ours, is not a pretty sight when you look into it too much." As a final thought this evening on the nature of empire, I simply wish to close with a few words from the Greek playwright Aeschylus, who crafted the play The Persians more than 2,400 years ago. One of the characters reflects, and I quote, "All those years we spent jubilant, seeing the trifling, cowering world from the height of our shining saddles. brawling our might across the earth as we forged an empire, I never questioned. Surely we were doing the right thing. It seemed so clear. Our fate was to rule. That's what I thought at the time. But perhaps we were merely deafened for years by the din of our own empire building, the shouts of battle, the clanging of swords, the cries of victory. Let's take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come back. We'll quickly introduce ourselves, first names, so people can get names and faces together, and then we'll open it up.
I'm Lauren Steiner, and I had said to John that I totally agreed with everything that he said about the dominant view is, but what the real view is, the history of what America has done, the ramifications, the rationalization, the pompous, you know, paternalistic, arrogant rationalizations. But where I part company is when you made your comment about there is no distinction between the hard and soft imperialism, it's just two heads of the same coin. I think you're painting the motives of people, and I use people to include not only the leaders, but also the American people that follow the leaders passively, as too malevolent. I think things are a lot more complicated than that. I think this is, in fact, what has happened. But if you look at the Iraq war, for instance, right now, I think there were a lot of different motives that went into that. I think surely Cheney is as evil as they come. He's extremely, he's intentionally imperialistic. I think he wanted maybe not so much the oil, but he wanted the contracts for Halliburton, for Bechtel, for Fluor, all the rebuilding. You know, I think Rove went in there because he saw that this is where Bush could be powerful, be the war president. But from what I've read about the neocons, Wolfowitz, Pearl, they all studied under, I guess it was Irving Kristol at Yale maybe 30 years ago. The book was The Rise of the Vulcans. And I think it's possible that certain leaders just believe this stuff, you know, that they really do think that we have this sort of manifest destiny to make the world a better place. And I do think, like you said, that it is inculcated in the American psyche. I would think that most Americans that don't really understand this history and just kind of listen to the propaganda that the leaders are putting forth actually do think that we are doing a good thing. So I don't necessarily think it's in America's national character. I don't think you can really talk about a national character. I think you can really talk about human nature. And I think it's kind of messy. I mean, if you look at human nature, are we good? Are we evil? Well, I think we're a combination of both. And for every internment of the Japanese or anti-Semitism, you can point to the abolitionist movement. You can point to the civil rights movement. I mean, there are things in the Americans or in human characters that are good and not imperialistic in the negative sense.
Well, thank you. I'll jump in later and introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Laura. And I agree with what you say up to a point. I agree that the people who are, say, fighting in Iraq, you know, the ground soldiers, don't have the same motives as our leaders, quote unquote. I agree that maybe there are some people who have some idea of spreading democracy. I believe that most of the people actually fighting are just surviving. That's what they see as their survival, joining the army. But even the people of color who are fighting on the ground, even those people share something that goes all the way up and down the hierarchies of our society. And if you think that it's not there, in addition to good intentions, there is out and out hardcore racism. And that's up and down the entire society. And that's what really, I think, enables us to keep carrying on this way. It may not be acknowledged, but it's there. That's an addition, not in spite of or opposed to what you say.
I'm Deirdre Lashgary. I would add that the racism you're talking about can go hand in hand with a self-perceived benevolence, that we really care about the people who need to be raised up, and that muddies things even further. I think there's a lot of people bought the argument that we really wanted to lift up the Iraqis by bestowing democracy on them.
Charles Fredericks. Racism is a word. Nationalism is a word. There are various other words that we could use that I think are also applicable. But it's kind of ways of identifying, separating a group of people from another group of people. And it seems to me that throughout history, wherever there's been a perceived difference, there have been those who have stepped in and thought, how can I turn that difference to my advantage? And stepped forward to be the leaders of any kind of imperial endeavor. an argument for saying that it has definitely been part of our national character from the very beginning can be found in the Declaration of Independence, where we chastise the King of England for I'm speaking as identifying with the early founding fathers, but they chastise the King of England for not defending him against these horrific savages, and then in the next breath saying, and because of this stupid treaty you signed with the French, we can't go beyond the Alleghenies and take what we would want to take. You're holding us back from our natural right to expansion. That's there in the Declaration of Independence. You know, it was there in the national character as the nation was being formed, which is understandable because it was a part of the British Empire. Everybody who was there, who was rebelling against the king, were also the part of an empire. The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. You know, you may do things differently than your parents, but they're the ones who brought you into the world and you learned all their tricks.
I have a comment to make, but let's wait till some other people have had their say.
Stuart Chandler. Let's not forget there's racism, and there's a wide variety of them. The racism that we're speaking of initially has to do with an encounter with a completely unknown quantity. The first Americans, I like the way he puts it, and how they saw some value in what they were doing, because they'd starve without the example of the first Americans, and a lot of them did. And those who cooperated with the first Americans made it, and those that threw out their example starved. But what's happening right now is, I'm sorry, but there's neo-Nazi graffiti appearing in Baghdad. We have now lowered our sights so far in our imperial army that indeed a new brand of racism has infiltrated our army. We have skinheads who are growing their hair, who avoid talking the talk, listening to white power music, and they're all over the army, and it's only going to get worse because no one wants it to do what they're doing, that is to go over there and kill other races. Like I say, there's racism and there's racism. And what we're reading about here is the beginning. It's almost a religious-based sense of separation, the Christian mission of manifest destiny that began, you know, as far back, perhaps even as the Declaration of Independence. So we better watch our comment on racism because it's gotten much, much different. It's like a metastasizing cancer. It's different. It's gotten much, much more powerful in it, going in a different direction than our original kind of racism.
You'll see when we get to the Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz article next month that the nature of racism, white supremacy, being absolutely critical to understanding the founding and the history of the United States and imperialist policies. This is not an aberration that just cropped up now and then in a particular administration, but it is rooted, it is a pattern, as Williams argues. It is institutionalized. It goes from generation to generation, and that's something we'll come back to.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jay Johnson from Santa Monica. I'm interested in the definition of imperialism because, as we understand it, we can then help to alleviate it or be aware of it. To me, it seems that there's such a thing as positive imperialism and negative imperialism, territorial imperialism and market-driven imperialism, that most civilizations in the history of humanity have had one degree of imperialism or another. I think it's, in one way, endemic to simply a function of government to want to either, quote, improve itself or expand itself. I think of the former Soviet Union at the end of World War II had the Eastern Bloc countries, that the ostensible reason, which I believe, which was defensive in nature, that Hungary, Romania, Czechoslovakia, etc., Poland, etc., were set up primarily by Stalin in his thinking as a defensive reaction to Western imperialism. But in its own way, it was imperialist because obviously it, quote, took over those other countries. Perhaps the people in those countries have different views on this, but I'd like to explore, do we make distinctions between so-called good or positive imperialism or negative imperialism, things that are done for purely expansionistic, oppressive reasons, such as gathering new markets, versus the issue of defensive imperialism, which would be for a defensive and protective purposes.
Jay, just quickly for the group, if you had to think of an example of a negative and a positive imperialism in the world over the last few hundred years, what would you...
Obviously, negative imperialism would be the Ottoman Empire. 400 years, Middle East, nothing happened. I think if you look at India with the British, negative was subjugation of the peoples. Positive would be my example of the Soviet Union, Eastern Bloc countries, as defensive. meaning protecting themselves, or, if you will, the concept of good imperialism or positive imperialism is for a defensive purpose.
All right, okay. In the back.
Yeah, my name is Hollis. And hegemony actually is the idea of it is that it takes over and becomes a dominant ideology to the place that people begin to internalize it and act upon it as though it's in fact reality, and even if it goes against their own best interest in some cases. But imperialism and or hegemony in fact takes, it's imperative for it to operate that there be a control group that supports it. In the case of our country, we keep talking about democracy, and probably most people, or many people, and maybe even in this room, would think we're some sort of a democracy, when in fact it's an autocracy, and a small elite is able to control most things. And it was designed that way, which a lot of people aren't aware of. If you read the Federalist Papers, number 10, and you really look at that, then you begin to understand the structure of our country and why it's the way it is. It didn't just happen. The people who were setting it up wanted to have hegemony, and they designed a structure that would work. And that structure is like internal imperialism as well as external, because they end up controlling our thought patterns and our way of doing things, such we say, well, I'm an American, and I'm patriotic about America. I consider myself, by the way, to be a world citizen, not an American. I am an American by birth, but I'm a world citizen because I really don't, when it comes down to it, I want liberation struggles to succeed in the world. I was one of the people, like I supported SWAPO and things like that in the 60s and the 70s and the early 80s, and I still believe that the national liberation struggles are something worthy of support by Americans who consider themselves to be lefts and progressives, and not to support any kind of thing that American economics can help other countries. We don't help other countries. We go there for our purpose, not theirs. It's part of our belief system that people end up internalizing the idea that somehow we will help them. I don't think people need our help. I think they're well able to help themselves. If we just get out of their way, they probably do a hell of a lot better.
Just a brief note, Hollis's comment about the Federalist Paper, especially number 10, in which Madison really articulates the class nature of this society. People might disagree with some of the policies of the founding fathers, but when you read the Federalist Papers put together by Hamilton, Jay, and Madison, these men gave very, very serious thought to how to govern a country. And Madison was quite upfront about the power relationships and imperial relationships, class nature of relationships that Williams will discuss in his book. And this came out in the debate, of course, to get people to support the ratification of the Constitution. And as some of us remember from our discussions with the Zinn Group, that I would argue that there are no series of American U.S. political leaders since who have really taken that understanding of political theory and governing a country to those levels. I mean, the discussions today about politics are a joke compared to what Madison and Jefferson and Franklin and others discussed 200 years ago, even though I'm sure, I mean, I'd be one of them, the nature of their policies and what happened and the oppression, but they spend quite a bit of time talking about this.
My name is Jack. Very good lecturer and persuasive. You know, you're saying things that don't seem to me astounding. They have a certain obvious quality to them. As a young kid, I saw what happened to the Native Americans as a kind of awful thing. So given that what you're saying is obvious and easily provable, I think, why does there exist the dominance myth that none of this happened? And people walk around in a trance with the notion that, in fact, you're unpatriotic, you're a deviant. All of us in the room here, we should not say any of this when we go out on the street.
Well, of course, of course. I'm sure none of you are going to.
So from a psychological standpoint, I'm interested in why such a myth takes hold and remains and is so strong. You know, even sociologists will talk to about American exceptionalism. We're different from everybody else, you know? And it's, you know, sociologically proven. You know, it's interesting to contemplate why the myth persists so strongly in the face of so much evidence to the contrary. But to even add to that, you know, the fact is that the elements of what you talk about as this American belief system is held throughout the world, here and there, and what, you know, not uniformly. I think there are very strong counter opinions, but the view of America in this idealistic image as doing no harm, as being the center in the universe of freedom and democracy and good values. You find it everywhere. And so I think to think about the power of this belief and why it holds in face of the contrary evidence is quite an astounding thing to kind of like.
One more comment, and then I'd like to try to touch on some of the thoughts that you've raised in response.
My name is George Torok. John, it's not a rhetorical question, by the way. I just want your feedback on something. You know, we've done a pretty good job of identifying what the problem is in the 20th century with American foreign policy. Would we, in fact, be better off just going back and practicing an extreme form of isolationism where the U.S. takes the attitude, you know what, it's not our problem, leave us alone, we can't get involved, we're not going to get involved, so therefore we can't get blamed if something goes wrong. Do you think that's a better alternative? And again, it's not a rhetorical question. I just kind of want your opinion on that.
I want to respond to a couple of things, and that's certainly an issue that, to some degree, I'm going to frustrate during these months, mainly because I think it gets us ahead of the analysis that we need to struggle with. Sort of the short answer to it would be that, of course, the United States cannot remain uninvolved in the world as a nation, given our size, given our economic power, given our military power. If we mean the idea that the United States will not be involved in any foreign activities, economic, political, or military, I mean, I think that kind of a world does not exist. What that means is something we're going to debate here. I'd like to get back to, well, Jack's comment and question. Why is it? That is, it appears that if you did a very systematic, objective, historical, engaged in historical scholarship, in which you just followed the evidence and you did not censor yourself, that in our public document, right, this is still even though there is censorship and self-censorship, this is still a relatively free society in which in our libraries and on the internet, et cetera, there's a vast amount of information about all of this, especially things in the past. You know, now we know about what happened in Guatemala, and of course you will read about it in very excruciating detail in Greg Grandin's book. But many of us at that time, of course, I was 14 years old, I don't even know if we, you know, other than studying our little brown neighbors to the south, whom we always loved, who knew what was going on in Guatemala? So many of those things were kept secret from the American people, from adults, and for those of us in high school at 14 years of age, I don't know what you were doing at 14 years of age, but you know, I was hoping the Yankees were going to beat the Cleveland Indians in the 54 pennant race. But who knew from Guatemala? Who knew what was happening? Who knew about Iran the year before when I was 13? So when I've struggled with this over 31 years of teaching and more than 6,500 students, most of whom, when they came into class, had not engaged in any critical work, did not know Zinn, did not know Chomsky. It was rare that, you know, they knew Jefferson, had never read the 10th Federalist paper, etc. As I think back with the luxury of hindsight 5 years down the road, I think one of the answers to the why is we simply were not exposed to critical perspectives that challenge the dominant view, which we were inundated with day in and day out by our teachers, by the mass media. I mean, some of us, I'm sure, you had a teacher now and then who would come in. I remember a high school history teacher would come in with The Nation and The New Republic and just go around. He was a very autocratic guy, but he went around and said, all right, I want you to read this article. I want you to do this. He introduced another way of looking at the world, and then The New Republic was quite liberal and to the left, which it, for those of you who haven't seen The New Republic lately, it is not. Okay, it has moved. So we didn't have the critical tools. Some of us didn't even know where Guatemala was or Iran. We couldn't have found it on a map. So I think part of it, because I sort of come out of this rationalist tradition that we can't challenge the dominant view if we don't know some basic history. So I was helpless, and I don't think I was unique, in East High School in Rochester, New York in the 1950s. My experience was repeated generation after generation. So I think that's one of the answers, that the things we're going to read are not still widely available. They're much more available today than they were 50 years ago. I mean, those of you who are in the Zinn group, Howard Zinn's People's History has sold 1 million copies in the United States, and that means more than 1 million people reading it. It is used in some high schools. It is used in many college classrooms. That kind of history was not there in the 50s and even the 60s. So it's not having everything on the table and then not having mentors to help us analyze, challenge, I mean, the kinds of questions, Lauren, you raised, where we can have a debate and a real dialogue and argue it out and see which perspective really holds up. Where's the evidence for these arguments? And that's something we have to come back to, because we're not the mainstream in this room, in case any of you had any illusions about that, okay? We are not, okay? Most people don't read Zinn. They haven't heard of Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky. They don't read Dunbar or Tease. And it has nothing to do with their brainwaves or anything. It's just you need the opportunity. It has to be introduced. So,
my name is Ken Hunzinski, and I realize this is a history sort of review, not theoretical, but I was wondering if you could separate the economic system and what the impact. The question I'm sort of asking is, what if we had a war and nobody profited? I mean, what would be the impact? No, I mean, it's serious. How much does the money have to do with it?
Well, when, as you'll see from William's book, from this article briefly, you'll certainly see in Dunbar Ortiz's article, you'll certainly see in John Bellamy Foster's article, that you can't separate economics from history and politics. They are linked. Everything is linked. I mean, you can pull them out as a scholar or a student to analyze them and say, okay, what happened economically with the banks, et cetera, as long as you remember that you're abstracting something that in the real world is connected. You can do it because we have the power to do that. You say, well, you know, I'm only going to look at the economic part. So you will see with the readings that we will be doing that the nature of resources, the struggle of resources, the exploitation of surplus, the involvement of money, in all of this is absolutely profound and is not unique to U.S. imperialism and has been the crux of empires over eons of time in terms of the struggle over resources. It has to be glossed. You got to tell a story after all. I mean, it'd be pretty difficult whether it was the French in Indochina or the Belgians in the Congo or the U.S. to really come out front and say, listen, we're going in, you know, I'm King Leopold, we're going into the Belgian Congo. We're going to kill, it may be 10 million people. It was one of the incredible genocides of the 20th or any century, again, of which none of us knew virtually anything, by the way. And I'm doing this so that I can ride in these really great horse-drawn carriages and have jewels and have lunch with Queen Frederica, whoever was his queen at that time. That rhetoric can't be said because it's too blatant. People would get it. So at base, I am going to argue a political economy thesis. That's what the thrust of the readings will be, and that's how we will proceed.
My name is Woody Nance. I think what we're talking about is this dominant narrative, and along with that is people's resistance or people's movements. I guess I got that from Howard Zinn, reading, studying Howard Zinn's book. So we have had people, oppressed people, and people who are discriminated against, and et cetera, who have fought back against the dominant narrative. But let's go back to Queen Isabella in Spain. I mean, she wanted two things. She wanted to find gold and land, and she wanted, since she was a Catholic nation, she wanted to spread the Catholic faith. And so this is the same thing that happened in Latin America and other parts of Africa and so forth when Protestant missionaries went over there and then big corporations came right behind them. I guess my question is, I think some of these people are rationalizing and they really do believe that they deserve to have this economic advantage because they're better or superior or whatever. Maybe they really have brainwashed themselves into believing that. But I do think that other people are just cynical and they don't mind using this. I think that's what's happening today. I suspect that's what is happening with the Bush regime. I think most of them are just cynical people who don't care, who if they're on the Titanic, they don't care as long as they're in the best suite. You know, if their policies are causing the whole planet to go down. And so some of these people are just using religious ideas and this, that, and the other to get the economic gain that they want. Now, we do have some resistance. I mean, we're really struggling right now in this country with, okay, can we break the Geneva International Law and really do torture? Can we do away with habeas corpus, that one of the most basic parts of our Constitution. And so there is resistance, which I think the resistance and the movements of people is what makes me feel good about being in the U.S., not the ruling class, not the imperialist ruling class.
All right. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Mona Levine, and I wanted to respond to your idea because I don't think it's an either-or thing. It isn't what we have now or isolationism. What we really need in the world is to share the resources of the world. It should be a redistribution of the world's resources. If we help other countries, believe me, the people in the country will be greatly appreciative. An example of that is in Cuba. In Cuba, they train doctors, thousands of them every year, and they send them all over the world. There's a wonderful movie called Like Angels. And you see the people responding to these doctors. They are so appreciative. And now they are not only training their doctors to go all over the world, they are now training people from all over the world to come to Cuba, learn how to be a doctor, and go back to their own country and help them. And that kind of kindness, or whatever you want to call it, is what will change the world. It's about sharing the resources, all our resources. We don't need to live so wealthy. It's so materialistic in our world. We can live a lot more simply and get a lot more out of it.
Just a note. And in order to begin to get the dialogue moving and to begin to sort of piece together different reflections. But as much as possible, as I indicated, we want to try not to go from 0 to 100. Try not to go from the analysis to what we should do. Because I think what will happen is we will go around the reading and around the arguments, and because they are distressing, we'll then understandably want to talk about what it has been done in Cuba, which has per capita more doctors outside its borders than any country in the world. But just try to resist that when you get into the reading, because again, otherwise it'll end up being, you know, how do we fix this immediately without the diagnosis?
My name is Brian, and John's normal, splendid presentation. He touched lightly on the territorial imperative of empire. And I think it should be expanded upon. The English gave up India as a territory in 1947. They didn't give up their economic power over India in 1947. In fact, they hold considerable economic power still over India. And it indicates a time of transition. The last 50 years has provided some great opportunity to have economic power over another nation. And it's definitely an empire. And it's definitely an imperial control. Well, without going into the history, I just think it should be something that we should discuss more thoroughly.
So is this on? Hi, my name is Turaj. In response to your comment or question about the psyche, it's a very profound question, I think. And part of it has to do with the fact that our foreign policy has been off the table from a democratic discussion. We are not to discuss our foreign policies. This is left to the experts, it's left to the State Departments and the PhDs and the people who know how to deal with it. And for the rest of us, we just basically listen to what they have to say. So the leadership, and especially the executive power, they have the resources and the know-how to do the foreign policy, and we cannot argue with them. And I think that's a great source of distress for the rest of us.
One of the things that Williams will discuss in the book, and I think Bellamy Foster also gets to it, but Williams certainly, is that the imperial state, and especially post-World War II United States, that the dramatic increase in power in the executive branch of government to create the conditions for war and take us to war, and the removing of Congress, for the most part, from a democratic deliberation. Because as you recall, Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution states very clearly, that it's not vague as they say the Geneva Convention might be, Congress shall declare war. The United States Congress has not declared war since December 8, 1941, when Franklin Roosevelt went before Congress after the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor. The United States has been involved in hundreds of covert and overt armed incidents since that time. There have been some resolutions, but there has not been a single declaration of war. So Williams is going to argue that the whole democratic nature of society, which means public dialogue on the fundamental issues, in which, of course, there are people who may be expert in an area and study a region of the world, but that it must always be brought to the democratic dialogue, the governing body of the country. That increasingly has been removed. And he, of course, in 1980 and through the end of his life, found that very, very distressing. That doesn't guarantee that in a real democratic debate that your perspective about whether we should go to war or not is going to be the one that passes. But just the idea that this is a momentous decision, the most fundamental decision a government takes is to go to war. And, you know, there have been some debates. You remember there was a debate before the first Gulf War, right? It was a resolution. It was not a declaration of war. The resolution in October 2002, which gave Bush the approval to do whatever he thought was necessary. Again, there was debate and discussion, but it was a resolution. It was not a declaration of war. So that's an issue we have to come back to.
Hi, Jay Johnson again. Earlier tonight, I submitted that there could be, or that there is, both positive imperialism and negative imperialism. I'd like to get feedback on three other kinds that I've come up with. One is territorial imperialism, which is the classical territorial-based imperialism we all are familiar with throughout history. But the other two, one is market imperialism, where it's not control of a property, of a territory, it's actual control of the markets, which I think is the new phase, the more sophisticated 21st century phase of imperialism, which is market imperialism, and the third would be ideological imperialism, such as socialist movements over the last 50 years to develop socialism internationally as an ideology and in some cases not be tolerant of opposition to it as compared, obviously, to capitalist ideology, which, of course, is overwhelmingly the dominant now.
So, for example, a market imperialism would be in which...
Where you do not control the country, but you do control the market. NAFTA jumps to mind as an example.
Okay.
Or conversely, the Caribbean countries have Mercator, where Mercator is not imperialist, it's just the opposite. It's a non-imperialist. NAFTA would be the perfect example today. But there have been historical, the control of the Seven Sisters of the oil riches of the Middle East.
Right.
That would be market imperialism. We didn't control the countries, we just controlled all the resources, which is all that mattered. And there's 50 other examples of market imperialism.
So these are different forms of imperialism. So therefore, and the one, especially market imperialism, neoliberalism, etc., far more than the overt invasions of countries. But still, the object, you would argue, is you can control the nature of a country in the interest of some in a dominant...
You just want to control their resources. You could care less about the country.
Right.
That's what's going on in the United States, is where the power elite is controlling the resources could care less about the people in this country. We're doing it to ourselves.
Okay.
And the other would be ideological imperialism.
So, Mansoor.
My name is Mansoor. You mentioned something about the imperialist system having a ruling class. And I would like to expand on the ruling class, that what are this ruling class's issues? And those issues will become as of ideology. And the ideology is interpreted for us, the commoners, or at least for me, the commoner. And we carry that ideology within us of somebody else, of some different class, that I have it in my brain, right? That it says, I'm the American, I'm the better than the guy in India. Better than the guy in Africa because they get $1 per day for what they do, and I buy a coffee, it's $2. I want to break it down to what it is that I'm carrying with me, okay, that ideology. And part of that ideology or interpretation or the psyche would be the culture and the language that we use. Is it my language that I'm using? What am I representing here? Am I representing the ruling class? And who's this ruling class in my language and lexicon that I'm using? Or am I using... working class language or internationalist language, or as the gentleman in the corner alluded to, that I'm a planetarian citizen rather than, you know, just because I'm born here, I'm not guilty. Okay, so with that in mind, then what I really would like to learn, it's the benefit of this system. Who's benefiting from it? If the working class is benefiting from this system, what is the comparison? I mean, if the guy who causes the war and goes after the resources in Yugoslavia and gets $10 billion the first day and I'm getting one extra cup of coffee, I'd like to know that. You know, am I getting 2 cents per his $2 million? you know, as a working class. Okay, so I think if we break this one down, then my last point would be, as a citizen, what am I going to do? How am I going to fight my fights? You know, if I get in the street and I want to say, come and join me for this struggle, do I just say, hooray, 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 I'm an American and I'm anti-war, but I can reap the benefits of soldiers being in Iraq, and I can just walk around, drive around in this city, up to yin yang of the hours of the day, go to restaurants, what have you, right? But I'm still saying, I'm anti-war, you know? How are we going to interpret all this? How are we going to bring this thing down that hopefully at the end of this year we can break down to the dialogue that we have? So at least we would find out in this society who is my enemy, really. I mean, literally that I can fight against for in a cultural way, not with any sort of deadly weapons or so. And just one last thing. Anybody under age of 40, please raise your hand here. Under 40. Okay, so here's part of the culture that we carry with us, and that is we don't have teenagers with us. So maybe next time we come, bring a teenager with you. I have promised myself I'm going to bring one teenager with me so he can sit and learn from all this. You know, at least if nothing else, he will sit in quietly back there, get bored to death. But at the end of 1 year, once a month, this is how the changes come. You got to bring somebody with you who doesn't know these things. And if we just continue doing the same thing over and over, might as well we go find an island and live there.
As you were talking about the sort of these dominant ideologies, the language, especially in the West, especially in societies like the United States and Western Europe, Japan, Canada, Australia. I think one of the best people who's written on this was the Italian Antonio Gramsci, who wrote about ideological hegemony. Gramsci actually was in the same socialist group with Mussolini. They went different ways, and Mussolini ended up throwing Gramsci in prison, where he stayed for 11 or 12 years and then died shortly thereafter. But Gramsci went on to be one of the founders of the Italian Communist Party and wrote about how do you maintain dominance in a society without always reverting to coercion and violence, which, of course, happens and has happened in the United States. But for the most part, people believe, going back to why we believe things, most of us in this society have grown to believe these things, not because somebody beat us up and threw us into prison. They're like what Gramsci called breathing in education. You breathe in the taken for granted. What we think, what we take for granted are the most important things about a society. And how that defines how we see ourselves, how we see each other, how we see the United States in the Philippines in 1902, in Vietnam in 1965, in Indonesia, etc. And so if I've internalized that, and Hollis talked about ideological hegemony, if I've internalized those dominant views, remember both groups have to internalize this, the dominant group and the dominated group. Now the dominant group is the one that has the access and the power and the media. The dominated group, in a sense, is taking it in. But if I internalize that, I mean, you don't need a lot of police. You carry the police around in your head, okay? And we're free in this society to ask any of the kinds of questions we're asking tonight, all sorts of questions. But if I haven't been helped again critically with the tools to ask those questions, I'm helpless against the history that I've learned. And that's why we will always, always focus on history in this group. Because without a knowledge of the past, you cannot face the future. Historical amnesia is one of the big things in this society. So thanks for getting that out. So I will see people next month. Anyone wants these lecture notes, please send me an email.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.